From WXXI News, this is Arts Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It is Arts Friday, and our first Arts Friday connection was made in 1989. Director James Cameron released a film called The Abyss. The summer blockbuster told the story of a crew exploring deep water, very, very deep ocean water. They encounter an alien community, which might not be an entirely faithful thing to verified science, but that's Hollywood. The film won an Oscar for visual effects. But we're wondering, how many of the details regarding the actual missions, the actual science of deep water exploration, are accurate? How'd they do? The Little will show The Abyss. The Little Theater showing it on Monday, March 16th at 6:30 p.m. It's part of the Science on Screen series at the Little Theater. After the film, Dr. Charles Fisher will lead a discussion about the science involved at deep water. Dr. Fisher is a deep sea biologist and a professor in the biology department at Penn State University. That same day, he's going to give a separate presentation in Rochester about his work in studying the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico back in 2010. We're going to get to that coming up. First, let me welcome on the line with us now, Dr. Charles Fisher. Thanks for taking the time, sir.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
And also here with me in studio is Pete Wehner, who is the PR and marketing coordinator for the Little Theater. And Pete, of all the different things you do at the Little, Science on Screen's got to be among your favorite.
It really is. It's a great series, and it's just a lot of fun to be a part of.
Well, we're going to talk Abyss coming up. I also want to start at a different place and maybe a little bit more serious. But when we talk about the ocean floor, we tend to think of it as a building floor, flat, uniform. And before our program began today, I talked to Dr. Fisher about the challenge of traversing deep seas, the seafloor, particularly in light of the loss of Malaysian Air Flight 370. That's 1 year ago Sunday is when Flight 370 out of Malaysia went missing. It has not been found. It was a sophisticated $270 million airliner carrying 239 people, left very few clues about where it went. And Dr. Fisher, unfortunately, you seem to think it's unlikely that aircraft will ever be found?
Well, I think at this point in time, the lack of success suggests that they may not ever find it. You know, the ocean's a big, vast place, and it sank in very deep water. And although there is a lot of advanced technology to image the seafloor, the deeper you go, the lower the resolution of what you can see.
Is there an oversimplified approach that we take where we think, well, we generally know where it went. You know, if we don't find it today, we'll find it next week or next month.
Well, you know, I think that kind of approach, we think that way because we're used to the surface of the planet, where it's very easy to actually take pictures of the surface of the planet from space. But when you're over a deep ocean, you're not getting photographic images. You're just getting different kinds of remote sensing information.
Do we know how deep those waters are? And in general, when we talk about the deep, I don't know if we're talking 1 mile, 2 miles, five, more.
Well, you know, it really depends on who you're talking to. Most biologists will define the deep sea as sometime after all ambient light from the sun stops or below 500 meters or so.
And for you, then, that's a good definition. It's 500 meters. I'm trying to do some math in my head. So that's not even a third of a mile. Is that right? Where light stops?
Around I guess 500 meters is, let me do the math real quick. that's around about a quarter mile, I think.
Okay.
A little bit more.
And so if that's where light stops, we're talking, because the sea floor can be miles and miles below that, right?
That's right. And most of the time, light stops well above that, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll stop up in between 200 and 500 feet, depending on the clarity of the water. But yes, the seafloor gets much, much deeper than that. You know, it can go down to 11 miles and more in the deepest parts of the ocean.
And so even if the ocean floor were as flat as the floor in our kitchen, it would be difficult to find an airliner, but we have to also consider the fact that the terrain there, ocean floor terrain can be like any topography on land that we're used to?
Yeah, I mean, for much of the deep sea is relatively flat because of the accumulated sediment of just mud and things raining down on the seafloor over millennia. But in other parts of the ocean, you have mountains, mountain ranges, some very extreme topography.
We're talking to Dr. Charles Fisher, who is a deep sea biologist and coming to Rochester for a couple of events. on Monday, March 16th. So that's two Mondays from now. And at 6:30 p.m. on Monday the 16th, the Little Theater is going to show The Abyss. Dr. Fisher and I have both seen The Abyss years ago, and we're going to study up, right, Dr. Fisher? It's one of those films where I remember some shenanigans at Deep Sea, but I'd have to study up on all the details.
It's been a little while for me, too. I've got it coming on Netflix next week, and I will be brushing up.
To your knowledge, are there any alien civilizations living on sea floors or in deep trenches?
Well, you know, I've made about 150 dives to the seafloor, and I've yet to see any.
That doesn't mean that they're not there, by the way. That just means you don't have any evidence of them. But let me ask Pete Wehner, why did you choose and why did the Little Theater choose The Abyss for this?
Well, part of the idea for the series, Evan, Science on Screen, is basically to get films that don't often appeal to, you know, so like they're not often looked at as like, okay, these are educational films. Like you said, this is a blockbuster. It has a lot of, it has great visual effects. It wasn't an educational film, or it wasn't billed as such when it came out. It's mainly for entertainment. But the idea behind Science on Screen is that we can take some of these ideas that are in these films, and then so like everybody's watching it, they're having a good time, and then we can kind of connect those principles to some real educational stuff like Dr. Fisher is going to talk about. And so it brings out the education and the entertainment, and it brings out the entertainment in the education.
I think that's well said. And I also don't think we're giving anything away. If you want to go to The Little on Monday the 16th and check out The Abyss, even the trailer indicates that there are alien forms down there.
Right.
But we're not telling you if they're hostile or friendly and how the interactions go and ultimately how it turns out. But Dr. Fisher, I have a text from a listener named Jake, and he writes, I've seen Abyss almost more than Star Wars. Great movie. If I'm not mistaken, the liquid breathing solution they use at the end of the movie was a real idea, though I'm not sure if it's ever been tested in humans. Did that research go anywhere? I'm trying to remember. I think Jake is pointing out, obviously, oxygen is an issue, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but I think there was a liquid breathing technique they used to try to stay alive at those depths. Is that just Hollywood fiction? Anything in reality there?
Well, let's see. First of all, the reason they use the idea of this ever came about is that under pressure, water doesn't compress very much, but air compresses a lot. So anything having to do with air spaces is under, you know, a lot of pressure just to be compressed and to disappear. And if you have pure gas in that kind of situation, the partial pressures would be astronomical at those kinds of depths. You know, I'm not sure that I know all of the technology there. I do know that superoxygenated fluids have been used with mice, and that mice have been able to breathe these liquids underwater as well. Of course, you know, they're immersed in the liquids. I don't know that any experimentation on humans has gone forward, but it certainly is an idea based in science.
I confess, I'm terrified of deep water. And, I mean, Pete Wehner, would you go deep sea diving?
There's no way. There's no way I would go down there.
Dr. Fisher, do you remember, you said how many expeditions, 150 you've done?
I've made about 150 dives, yeah.
Do you remember your first?
I do remember my first. And I remember being worried about being claustrophobic because I did go down in the Alvin, which is basically a 6-foot diameter titanium sphere with three people inside it. But as soon as you start going down, you get so excited about what's outside that there really was no claustrophobic effect at all. And I was just entranced all the way down. And I was diving and actually my first love, which was studying the animals that live around deep sea hydrothermal vents, deep sea volcanoes. And those animals are just so strange and so weird that to actually see them on the seafloor took my breath away. I had no intellect left over for fear.
If our listeners have any questions or comments about this, we're going to have Dr. Fisher on here for a good part of the hour as we talk about deep sea life, conditions at those depths, what's coming up in Rochester. And we're also going to talk coming up a little bit later about the Deepwater Horizon, of which he has done a good amount of work and will be going back next month. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Where was your first dive and how deep?
See, my first dive was to a hydrothermal vent site off the coast of Mexico, 21 degrees north on the East Pacific Rise. And I don't remember the exact depth. I'm say it was at about 2,000 meters. So it was a little bit over a mile deep.
Wow. I mean, Pete and I are both shaking our heads saying never, ever would I do it. But but for you, when we talk about light, light past a third of a mile, there's no light. When you're down there, how far can you see with whatever light you're using?
Well, you know, it depends on the lights that you're using. And back then, the lights weren't nearly as good as they are now. So we were largely limited to looking, let's say about 30 feet, maybe a little bit more, that you could see well if you looked out the portals of the submarine. We've got better lights now, and we can see a bit further, but you never see more than, I would say, 60 or 70 feet in the deep sea.
Describe what you saw there. You said it was strange. The creatures are beautiful, strange, and weird. Tell us about it.
Well, at these places in the middle of the ocean where the plates that make up the planet are spreading apart and there's undersea volcanoes, there's animals that live on the energy that's coming up in hot water from the center of the Earth. And at that site, the most spectacular animals were giant tube worms that were many of them 3 feet and 4 feet long and several inches around, bright red plumes in clumps, and arranged in communities with a biomass. The amount of animals in these communities is the same as what you find on a coral reef. It's just it's a spectacular density of animals and variety of animals. And they're actually quite colorful when you put the lights on them.
So I was wrong. There are aliens down there. I don't know why I said that. Nothing James Cameron created sounds as scary as what you just described.
No.
Well, you know, James Cameron made another movie that's shown in IMAX called Aliens of the Deep, and it's all about the animals you find around these deep-sea spreading centers.
Well, let me grab a phone call. This is in Mendon. Keith, go ahead. Keith, you're on with Dr. Charles Fisher.
Evan, you just took away my thunder. I was going to disagree with the doctor about aliens in the ocean. I'm sure there's still undiscovered life forms down there. So that was one thing that he just killed for me. But the other thing was what I liked about the movie was the plot. Well, I thought the plot was about, and I don't want to give it away for anybody who hasn't seen the movie, to what it turned out to be. I thought that was really good.
Can you speak about it as spoiler free as you can, Keith? But go ahead.
Well, what you thought it was about Big and Little Geek, I think the name was. What ultimately the bad guys were trying to do, that's what I thought the whole plot was about until you go into the movie and you realize, no, there's another. What you thought the plot was actually turned into be the subplot.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was really good.
And Keith, as someone, we've talked to you on this program a number of times. I know you are keenly interested in science. How much do you watch a film like that and want the science to be accurate?
Well, I don't want the science to be accurate. I want it to be somewhat maybe theoretically possible, mm-hmm. somewhat plausible. But I have a big thing about traveling at light speed because technically you would be there before you left. I have a suspect about wormholes and folding time and all this stuff.
Sure.
But if it's somewhat, if it's remotely possible, okay. I mean, the one thing about space travel is, okay, let's say you can overcome light speed, all right? Let's say you can go two times light speed. Can you imagine how much time you need to slow down or making a left-hand turn? The inertia on that would, you know, probably crush you beyond atoms. I digress on that.
Well, all good points, Keith. And let me ask Dr. Fisher then. Keith is giving a realistic take on how we are when we sit and watch the abyss. As long as it is not absolutely ludicrously impossible, I think we give science some leeway. But let's talk a little bit about the science the farther down you go. I assume there's a difference between being 1 mile down and 2 miles and between 2 miles and 5 miles and the impact on what you're able to do, pressure, breathing, et cetera.
Well, yeah, there is. I mean, the biggest changes as far as life goes actually happens you know, in the first few hundred feet, down to 1,000 feet or so, because the animals that live down there can't have any air spaces. They just have all liquid spaces. When you think of it, is a very inhospitable environment for animals that are not adapted to it like us. But the really, to me, one of the really amazing things is that over evolutionary time, thousands of different groups of animals have evolved what it takes to live there. And it turns out that evolutionarily speaking, it's not that big a step. A couple little tweaks in the membranes and a couple little tweaks in the proteins, and you can live under all that pressure. It's just that if you're not adapted to it, it can be quite inhospitable.
On Twitter, Eric writes to Pete and myself and says, "You are wusses. It's just like the deep end of a pool with maybe another 5,267 feet or so to go." And I'm sorry, Eric. It's 5,267 feet for the first mile. What's the farthest? What's the farthest depth? What's the deepest you have been, Dr. Fisher?
Let's see. My deepest dive was about 2 miles, 3,600 meters, close to 2 miles. And at those kind of depths, you get in the submarine, you turn on your music, and you get comfortable, because it'll be close to an hour and a half before you get to the sea floor, to where you can work for about 5 hours, and then you turn on the music again and get comfortable for the hour and a half it'll take you to get back up.
You're describing it in a way that I describe going to work. You know, no big deal. And granted, I know when you've done this dozens of times, that may be the mentality. But is there a fear, either of the unknown or of what could happen?
Not for me. You know, when I get into the Alvin submarine or another submarine, I realize that I am in a vehicle that's got a better safety record than cars, planes, trains, or bicycles. And so I really don't have any fear about that. The pilots that fly these submarines, for them it is a day's work. You know, they eat their breakfast, hop in the sub, go spend a day in the office on the seafloor, and come back up for dinner.
Talking to Dr. Charles Fisher, who is a deep sea biologist at Penn State University, and he will be coming to Rochester Monday, March 16th, 6:30 p.m. He is going to be here at the Little Theater as they show The Abyss as part of the Science on Screen series, and then Dr. Fisher will help lead a discussion about the science involved at deep water. And we had a number of snarky comments on Twitter making fun of Pete and myself, but I also saw a comment asking about the kinds of creatures down there. So, Dr. Fisher, when you are down a mile or two and you turn the lights on, how often are you seeing creatures, I use the term creatures, an animal, fish, whatever it is, that you don't immediately recognize?
Well, it really depends on where you are in the deep sea. And there are some fundamentally strange-looking creatures down there. So, I would say, honestly, that hardly a dive goes by where I don't see something that I don't recognize, which doesn't mean somebody else wouldn't recognize it. And we take pictures. But, you know, I've also gone down and collected animals, and we brought them back up, and nobody on the ship or no experts we could send pictures to knew what they were. And we've discovered new species, sometimes new families of animals. It's a very unexplored realm, and a lot of the animals down there don't make it up in good shape if you use nets to collect them. So those are the kinds of animals you often will see for the first time through a if you're using a robot to explore the seafloor, or if you're actually in a submarine looking out.
And when it comes to the science in the film The Abyss, if I remember correctly, and again, I'm going back years to when I saw it, if I remember correctly, one of the characters on the crew becomes aggressive towards what they find down there, and I think that they chalk that up to a kind of paranoia related to high pressure or pressurized environment. Is that a Hollywood invention, or is there an impact on the way we behave when we go down that far?
There is an impact on the way we behave. There can be neurological impacts, both, and the type of impact depends on the type of dissolved gases that are used. I've personally experienced nitrogen narcosis when I was scuba diving and went down at just about 200 feet, and you feel like you're a little bit drunk. It gets you a little bit stoned. I think in that case it was a helium mixture, and I know there are neural effects. I don't know whether paranoia was an accurate a reflection of those effects or not.
So before I let Pete go and we turn our attention to some of your other work, especially in regards to examining what happened after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, Pete, what are you most looking forward to on Monday the 16th?
Really, I think your caller, Keith, said it best when he, you know, take a look at some of the things that are maybe possible or maybe, you know, invented and like you've been talking about through this whole show. But really, that's the beauty of this program. And so when I'm really looking forward to watching all of this unfold in a very cinematic James Cameron way and then hear Dr. Fisher say, you know, yeah, I mean, it's an alien landscape and, you know, these things could happen. Who knows? Like, but, you know, hearing from his personal experience, because obviously I've never gone more than, you know, 10 feet down in the deep end. So
Dr. Fisher, you said you're going to brush up on the science in it. What will you be watching for as you watch the film again?
Well, you know, I can remember when I watched it the first time. I was watching it with other graduate students at UC Santa Barbara, where I was a grad student. And I think it was grad student, but other deep-sea biologists, because what I distinctly remember were that we were kind of chuckling at some of the things like the speed with which the submarines maneuver. Your caller mentioned, you know, making it hard to make a left-hand turn at light speed. Well, you know, it's hard to make a left-hand turn in a submarine, too, when you've got a little forward momentum and the water around you. So I'll be kind of watching that and the ways they treat pressure and our interactions with it and getting in and out of the ocean. I have a memory of them putting on a deep pressure suits to jump into the ocean and, you know, and then breathe their liquid oxygen, and yet jumping right from air into a moon pool and swimming out. If, in fact, there was that much pressure in the water he jumped into, that water would come right into the airspace he was standing in. So there were a couple of kind of cinematic licenses that were taken there that I will be brushing up on, but those two stand out in my memory from a bunch of deep sea biologists laughing at some of the little technical glitches.
The Little Theater is hosting Science on Screen with The Abyss Monday, March 16th, two Mondays from now, 6:30 p.m. the film, then the discussion led by Dr. Fisher afterwards. Pete, people can get tickets where?
They can get tickets at thelittle.org.
And how often do you do Science on Screen?
We do them, it's every spring, usually a cluster of three films. And so it's going to be this, like you said, March 16th, and then April 20th is another film, and then May 18th will be another film.
Are you allowed to tell us what they are?
Well, I know one for sure. Okay. The one coming up on April 20th is called Future Weather, and that's a really good one, very highly rated, but kind of under the radar, which is pretty much the Little's MO. And that's going to go into some climate change stuff. We're going to have James Hansen, who's a really famous and noted meteorologist, come and speak, so that's going to be exciting too. But yeah, we're really looking forward to this spring because it's going to be a lot of great Science on Screen films.
Great stuff. Thanks for coming in and sharing that with us. I will look forward to learning more about Science on Screen. Thank you, Pete.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Pete Wehner is the PR and marketing coordinator for the Little Theater, who is bringing Dr. Charles Fisher in. And Dr. Fisher is also going to be in Rochester to talk about his experience working after the Deepwater Horizon spill. And Dr. Fisher, when we talked earlier today, I said, when was the Deepwater Horizon spill? It's amazing how much time has passed. 5 years, coming up on 5 years since the Deepwater Horizon. In fact, April 20th, 2010, in the Gulf of Mexico, on the seafloor there. How far down on the seafloor do you know that spill happened?
Yeah, that was just about a mile. That was 1,400 meters.
1,400 meters, and from what I've been able to read, trying to kind of catch up my knowledge on what happened and what we know about it, we're talking about 4.9 million barrels, total discharge, 210 million U.S. gallons of oil. Is that correct? Is that roughly?
That sounds right. Yep, and over 90 days.
Over 90 days. And so so let's kind of back up just a little bit here. That oil flow was coming from the seafloor, and reports after those 90 days, I wasn't sure if the leak was totally contained. It's contained today? It's nothing else is coming from there? Is that right?
It has been contained, yes.
Okay. Your work subsequent to that spill has been what?
Well, you know, the spill is different than anyone in history in that it was emanating from such a deep depth. And as a result, there were several things that happened quite differently. And one was there was actually a deep water plume of oil and gas that never reached the surface, that traveled around the seafloor. And then the subsequent activities to remove it from the sea surface before it washed up on shore or went out of the Gulf, such as dispersant application and surface burning, resulted in a lot more of that oil being dumped into the deep sea. So I was brought in because I've worked in the deep Gulf of Mexico for several decades to help assess the potential damage to deep sea life in the Gulf.
And what do we know about the damage to deep sea life?
Well, we've learned quite a bit. Just like searching for a lost airplane in the deep sea, it's tough because all of your work is being done at a mile depth. Mm-hmm. And in some areas, it's very hard to see visually. I mean, a lot of the deep Gulf of Mexico is mud, and the people that have studied the impact of those communities have just taken cores all over, and they've demonstrated a lot of effects to those communities over, you know, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but I'm going to say it's on the, it's on the scale of hundreds of square miles. Now, I study larger animals, and we thought that the best animal to recognize an impact would be deep sea corals, because the corals are attached to the seafloor, and so they don't go away if they've been killed, like a fish or a crab might just wash away. And they stick up and they're exposed to the water. So we undertook a research effort to identify coral communities around the site of the spill and to look at those. And in short, what we found is that several coral communities within about 20 to 23 miles from the spill were impacted by the spill. 23 kilometers from the spill were impacted by the spill.
Was that a surprise how far-reaching it was?
It was. You know, the first report said it only went about 2 miles out. That the effects of serious oil on the seafloor, the first government report suggested that was largely limited to a radius of about 2 miles. Then the first site that we found was, and I'm doing the conversions from kilometers
about 15
to miles,
miles
in my head, but I'm going to say that it was about 7 miles
okay.
away. And that was a coral community that about half of them had been hit very hard. And in fact, when we were there in December of 2010, they still had muck on them containing oil from the deepwater horizon. And then a couple of years later, we found another site that was even further away.
So when you go back next month, what will you be looking for?
So we're going to do several things next month. First, we will visit the three sites that we found that have been most heavily impacted to follow the progression in those corals. Some of the corals and some parts of some of the corals are getting better, and other corals are starting to lose branches. You know, in the deep sea, things happen really slowly. These corals, some of them are 500 years old. So it's really taken a long time for the effects to play out. And we've been going back every year, and we're starting to get a good picture of what's happening, but we're not quite there yet. So that's one thing we'll do, is we'll go back to the sites and just see how everything's doing. And then we will also be exploring some other sites in the region where we think there's at least the potential for impact to better define the entire area that was impacted from the spill.
I think it is difficult and complicated to try to answer a question that people may have when they hear, okay, you're studying coral and deep sea life, but what does that mean for us or for other animal species, aquatic species, et cetera? I don't know that there is an easy answer for that, but how do you start to address that question when people say, okay, you're looking at coral, but what's the broader impact?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of ways to look at that question. One is that deep coral communities do provide homes for many other animals, including animals that may be fished. These could be larval grounds or breeding grounds, and some of the deep coral communities are breeding grounds for fish species that are fished. There's some deep water crab fisheries, and some of these deep water crabs tend to aggregate in these grounds. So there are some kind of direct effects on species of obvious interest to humans. But I think the real answer is that the entire ocean is connected. It is one large ecosystem. And even if those deep water corals are not providing ecosystem services to a fish species we eat, they are providing ecosystem services to many other animals in the deep sea. And when we impact the deep sea, we are impacting the biodiversity and all of the other kind of ecosystems that interact with the deep sea.
Yeah. And so finally, wrapping up here, when it comes to deep water, Dr. Fisher, sometime after the spill, we heard from, and I don't recall if it was BP or others, who were surmising that, yeah, this was a problem, but the ocean is huge, and that in the grand scheme of the ocean, that this is not going to have a long-term impact. Too soon to say if there will be long-term impact, or is it a danger to downplay it just because the ocean, as you've been saying, is so deep, so big, and so vast?
I think that the truth is somewhere in between, in that it could have been much worse. And the ocean does have the ability to absorb a lot of insults. I mean, we as a species have been throwing pollution and crud into the ocean for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
And in many places it was absorbed, in other places we've overwhelmed it. Now, the Gulf of Mexico is someplace that has been under a lot of pressure. I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners have heard about the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico that are largely the result of, runoff of waste and things being deposited in the Mississippi River. There's a lot of fishing pressure in the Gulf. There's a lot of development in the Gulf. So this is one more insult to an already stressed ecosystem. So the ocean, it will largely recover. We're not there yet. It's going to take some time, and we have made an impact that it did feel and is still feeling.
Dr. Fisher is a deep sea biologist and a professor in the biology department at Penn State University. Sounds to me like you like your work. Sounds to me like you really enjoy it. But but I hope you enjoy it even more so when you come to Rochester, not only to talk Deepwater Horizon, but separately at 6:30 p.m. two Mondays from now. That's Monday, March 16th at the Little Theater. The Little is going to show The Abyss as part of their Science on Screen series, the 1989 James Cameron film. And Dr. Fisher will lead a discussion looking at the science of it afterwards. I hope it's fun for you. It's going to be fun for us, and we certainly hope you enjoy it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I will see you all a week from Monday.
Dr. Fisher, thanks for taking the time.
Yes, sir.
All right. And we're going to take a short break on Arts Friday, and we're going to come back and talk about Rochester's rank when it comes to art vibrancy. There are rankings for this. And in some way, there's a lot to be proud of. But in others, it's an opportunity for us to look at who we are and what we do next. That conversation after this short break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking Greentopia. The Greentopia Film Festival is later this month. We get the full slate on what's coming up, the films, the people involved, and what you need to know to get involved yourself. That's Greentopia next hour, and we're also talking about a part of the city of Rochester that's becoming much more vibrant in arts and just about everything, the South Wedge. Join us next hour.
A new documentary film looks into the world of climate change deniers and their playbook for swaying public opinion.
You can just see this pattern used over and over and over again. And as they say, they don't have to win. They just have to create doubt and delay.
Robert Kenner's film Merchants of Doubt, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Arts Friday. Here's a rank for you. Sometimes we get intoxicated with lists, but I think this one is a little more detailed and important than most. Rochester ranking as the 20th most arts vibrant large city in America, according to the National Center for Arts Research that was recently released. And Tom Parrish is the executive director of Jiva Theater Center. He took a look at that list and asked a question. Now what? He's on the line with us. Tom, thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thanks for having me, Evan.
All right, so I see the list, and I think my first reaction is 20th in the country. You know, and based on the metrics they use, that there's a lot to be proud of there. But I think your post that you wrote, and we're going to get into some of that in just a moment, explores what we do with it. It's not just sort of being complacent with a ranking, I guess.
Right. Yeah, it's great to be among the best, but how do we as a community be the best?
How do we get to a 20th ranking? What are the things that a National Center for Arts Research is looking at when it comes to trying to rank how a city, you know, is arts vibrant?
Well, the National Center for Arts Research, which is located at SMU in Dallas, they have the largest collection of arts data probably anywhere in the United States. They add together all of the data from the various arts industry associations along with the state arts agencies, the National Endowment for the Arts, the IRS, and the Cultural Data Project. So they have a lot of data that they've collected. And so they look at that data and they tried to determine the vibrancy of a region based on measures of supply, demand, and public support. So they look at things like total ticket sales and program revenue and total contributed donations and total expenses, compensation, how many employees there are, and what's the level of government support in that region.
Government support, I think, is an interesting question, and that's always a push and pull in a debate. But you touched on something in the piece that you wrote in asking the question, if Rochester wants to be the city of the arts and climb the rankings, how do we turn these statistics into action or public policy? How would you like to see these statistics be turned into action?
Well, I think some things that came up as weaknesses for our region and what was keeping us from being higher than 20th relates to local public support and charitable contributions. And so that's an area that we should look at if we want to improve, as well as cultivating local artists and independent artists in the region. And then another thing pulling us down is sort of socioeconomic and regional unemployment. So tackling poverty, which is definitely the task of the anti-poverty task force. They're working on that and trying to boost employment.
Talking to Tom Parrish, the executive director of Jiva Theater Center, about Rochester's rank when it comes to arts vibrancy. 20th in the country for large cities, according to the National Center for Arts Research. And you just gave us a lot to chew on, but let me hit some of those points one by one, Tom. And I'm going to work backwards. You mentioned poverty. And certainly our community, just about every urban center is grappling with poverty. Rochester is grappling with more severe poverty than just about any city of its size in the country. And sometimes when we talk about arts, there are those who take the point of view that, well, that is a luxury category. That is a leisure or luxury category that does not apply to a conversation about poverty. I don't necessarily think that's true. What do you think?
Well, I think the art sector provides a lot of jobs, particularly for people that may be at or near the poverty level. So the strength of the art sector, that it's an employer of people who are near that poverty line. Also, just the general sort of GDP and fiscal health of people in the community is important for arts demand across the board. Some people may think that only certain economic segments participate in the arts, but data from the National Endowment for the Arts and arts participation actually shows that it spans the entire cross-section of the American public.
And when it comes to what makes up a city, what makes a city, you know, worth living in, I know you're going to tell me, and I think for good reason, but I will ask anyway. When it comes to art, if a city isn't emphasizing art, is there an impact, however hard it is to calculate, on quality of life, attraction of businesses, et cetera? We may never be able to put a firm number on it, but what do you think about that, Tom?
Well, I certainly think that there is an impact of a vibrant arts community on the health of a region. I think particularly among young people are attracted to vibrant, culturally rich places. And Richard Florida wrote his book, The Creative Class, probably 10 or 15 years, The Rise of the Creative Class, 10 or 15 years ago, that really spoke to those communities that are growing or those that are nurturing the creative class. And that includes artists as well as designers and architects and computer programmers, anyone who's creating output.
Okay, and now let me start to work through some of the other prongs that you mentioned that were analyzed by the National Center for Arts Research. Local public support. We're talking about, generally, we're talking about tax dollars, supportive programs, and you think Rochester could do better. Let's get specific. If you can, and you look around the community, and I know you're not casting aspersion on our elected leaders. Everybody's got to make hard decisions. But how can we do better?
Well, I think, you know, I can just use Jiva as an example, and I know that Jiva ranks in the 52nd percentile nationally for local public support, and that would be city and county support. And in Jiva's specific case, a professional theater in the United States, the average theater receives 1.6% of their budget from local governments, whereas Jiva receives 0.3%. And I think, you know, people can say, well, you know, that's good. The organizations are self-sustaining and they're not relying on public dollars. But the research out of the National Center for Arts Research actually shows that there's a positive correlation between the amount of public dollars an organization receives and the amount of private dollars it receives. So whether that public support lends legitimacy to the cause or whatever the reason, that public support is important for a number of reasons.
And when it comes to charitable contributions, private contributions, you also mentioned that being part of the list. How do we do as a community when it comes to private giving for art?
Well, I can't speak specifically to art. I can speak, well, so Rochester for arts vibrancy ranked 151st in contributed revenue for arts and culture. Sort of blowing that out a little bit to all charity in general, Rochester ranks as the 279th most giving community out of 366 major metropolitan areas. So Rochester, the metropolitan area, is in the bottom quartile as a percentage of disposable income given to charity in 2012, according to the Chronicle of Philanthropy.
It's a complicated question on why we would be 279th out of 366 measured. Some might take it as some sort of an affront because we have this mentality that we will always pull each other up. We will always give when needed. We will help when needed. But we don't rank that high in charitable giving. And I think some might come back and say, well, you know, we're taxed enough, we're struggling enough, et cetera, et cetera. And I know the answers are complicated. Do you offer any idea on how to improve that number?
Well, you know, I saw that number too, and it certainly runs counter to what we think about ourselves as Rochesterians, and so I was curious. And New Yorkers in general, all the New York metropolitan areas tend to rank lower in the United States than other places, and it may be related to the tax burden in New York versus other places. Thinking that the tax dollars are supposed to be doing the work of charity, that the charities are doing in other places. Mm-hmm. But I think here in Rochester, we can, you know, encourage and promote philanthropy as much as we can. And I think that's incumbent on organizations. And then it's incumbent on all of us as residents to try and dig deeper to build all charities, not just even arts and culture.
Talking to Tom Parrish, the executive director of Jiva Theater Center, who recently wrote a piece called Rochester Ranks 20th for Arts Vibrancy, Now What? So how about who to emulate? You look at other cities on the list, and for you, as someone who works in the arts community, what cities do you look at and say, there's one to emulate, or they're doing something particularly well?
Well, What's interesting is Rochester is actually the smallest metropolitan area in the top 20. So all of those that are doing better than us are larger than us. I think some similar size cities that are a little closer to our size that are in the top 20 are cities like Richmond, Virginia, Silver Springs, Maryland. But most of them are quite big. Actually, Nashville, Tennessee is not that much larger than Rochester, 750,000 people, but it's ranked second nationally. And it has a very vibrant, mostly music scene, but also some other artistic elements.
And are those communities generally more supported by both charitable contributions but also public dollars?
I'd have to dive into the rankings for each of the – well, I've got Nashville here. So Nashville, for contributed revenue, actually ranks 23rd. Compared to our 151st.
Okay.
So there is either more local public support or local private support going to support the arts in Nashville than there is here. They're also outspending us, and they're outselling us in terms of ticket sales and the like. And they have a lot more independent artists in the Nashville area and cultural employees.
Well, Tom, let me begin to wrap this conversation on what to do next with this then. We had a meeting yesterday here at WXXI, many people in the arts community, several from Jiva and many other organizations. As you know, WXXI has launched our Friday and Saturday night arts program called Arts in Focus. I'm proud to host it. And we had a lot of people talking about the arts community yesterday here in our building. And one of the comments that struck me was, I don't know who coined the phrase Silicon Valley, but everyone instantly knows what it means. And how does Rochester end up with a moniker that becomes a national name? You look at, Nashville as a music city. How does Rochester end up being a city of art or a city of creativity? I don't know. I'm not smart enough to know what the moniker should be, but can we get there?
Sure. I think it's about identifying our strengths and then promoting them. And so I know that the region's working through the Regional Economic Development Council to find, what are those areas that we're really going to hold up as this is Rochester and, we're the center of XYZ. So it's about coming to a consensus as a community as to what our strengths are and then promoting those with a unified voice.
Sure. And perhaps the comforting thing in that is I could tell you that I'm going to be the quarterback of the Buffalo Bills. And as bad as their quarterback situation is, it would not be true. They would not be interested in me. You can say whatever you want, but you have to back it up. And Rochester, when you look at this list that Tom writes about, composed by the National Center for Arts Research, sure, there are certain metrics that we are farther down the list, but when it comes to actual production of artistic endeavors, we do back it up in many ways, don't we, Tom?
Yeah, we certainly do. For a city of our size, on a per capita basis, we're producing a lot of cultural output. So we certainly could lay claim to the city of the arts, and we can make that case even stronger by bolstering up some of the things that we're a little weaker at.
And let me also ask you, because we talked about private contributions, Jiva went through a recent campaign, and how are things at Jiva now?
Good. The campaign continues to move along.
Yes. Thank you for correcting those. Jiva is in the midst of, hopefully on the back end of a campaign. Go ahead.
Yeah. We've raised $9 million of the $10 million we need to renovate the theater, so that's great and moving along, and we're starting plans to begin renovations this summer. And then we just finished Little Shop of Horrors, which had 25 sellout performances and sold at 90% capacity, which is great. And we've got a world premiere comedy on stage right now, Women in Jeopardy.
So 30 seconds, last question then for you. If Rochester is going to start to earn that more of that national reputation that would be associated with the City of the Arts, does there have to be more of a unified voice? Competition will happen everywhere. Competition should happen everywhere. But when it comes to, well, does Rochester need a new performing arts center? Should there be a new theater? Do we have enough theater? Should we renovate what we have? Those conversations have been happening for decades now. And are we more divided as a community than others are, Tom?
I wouldn't say we're more divided than other communities. I think we all talk to each other pretty well and are collaborating, and charting that the next course is always difficult, and you know, we'll come together to figure out the best solution for it.
For the most part, though, it does sound like a rising tide lifts all boats, and I try to stay away from lame cliches, but in this case, I think the arts community here generally recognizes that. And Tom, your piece had us thinking about a lot of different things. It will be very interesting to see going forward if we see any change when it comes to public support or the way the city simply markets itself. But thanks for getting us thinking about that.
You're welcome.
Tom Parrish, the executive director of Jiva Theater Center, and his piece, Rochester Ranking 20th for Arts Vibrancy, Now What? Short break, and we're talking about Greentopia Film Festival coming later this month. We're going to talk about the South Wedge of Rochester, a lot to talk about next hour on Arts Friday.